Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings and welcome to the Intelligent Design the Future podcast. This is Casey Luskin broadcasting with Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture in Seattle, Washington. We have on our show with us today an extremely special guest, Dr. Charles Thaxton, who in many ways can be seen as the founder of Intelligent Design, is here with us in the studio here from Atlanta, Georgia, and he is going to talk to us about the origin of life and his book, The Mystery of Life's Origin. So, Dr. Thaxton, thank you so much for coming and doing this podcast with us today.
Thanks, Casey. I've been looking forward to this.
Well, I've been looking forward to this for a long time, too, because it's not every day that we get to have somebody who has played such an historic role from the very beginning in the intelligent design movement here in our studio and ready to talk about these kinds of issues. So I think I'd like to pick your brain about many things, including the origin of intelligent design and many of your articles and your books and your ideas about the origin of life that have had such a huge impact. Can you maybe first start off by telling us a little bit about your own academic and educational background?
Academically, I received my PhD in chemistry from Iowa State University in Ames, Iowa. And the whole undergraduate and graduate was in chemistry. And I planned to teach, what was my hope when I started. And as things progressed, issues were raised, and I began to gradually phase into more specifically questions related to the beginning of life. So it didn't start out that way. It just began to happen as I moved in that way. My own personal questions and then looking for answers to them.
Okay. And you obviously went to Iowa State University, which is a university that many of our podcast listeners have heard a lot about due to the Guillermo Gonzalez tenure case. So yes. I have to ask you the question, because I think people might be interested in it. Was the climate at Iowa State different when you were there? Was it more open to people who might consider themselves skeptics of Darwinism or proponents of intelligent design?
Well, actually, when I first arrived at Iowa State, there were on campus a number of faculty members in various science and engineering departments who had a regular series during the year dealing with various origin type issues.
Oh, really?
And that went on for at least 2 years, maybe longer. And then gradually, as more and more students began to frequent these meetings, I think the administration began to take notice and say, well, this is obviously getting out of hand. And so they began to close the doors. But yes, there were quite a number of faculty members who participated in those years when I first arrived. And it was during the mid-60s.
Okay. So sounds like things were a little bit better possibly then, but there was still some resistance.
Well, it wasn't very often that anyone talked about it, and I think it was a novelty at first.
Okay.
And novelty can be tolerated.
Okay.
For a while.
So there were no atheist professors of religion passing petitions around to all the faculty getting to sign statements against intelligent design.
Oh, there were then also, but nobody paid them any mind.
Oh, I see. Okay.
It just wasn't politically correct to listen to that sort of thing until much later.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Well, so you graduated in what year from Iowa State?
1970.
Okay. And then it was soon thereafter that you got interested in questions about the origin of life. So what piqued your interest? What got you first thinking about those kinds of questions?
Well, actually, my interest started before I graduated.
Okay.
While I was still there, I heard lectures occasionally. A featured speaker at one of the evening seminars would deal with the question of the origin of life, and those were always well attended. And that was the first awareness that I had, really, that chemistry was applicable to these evolution-type questions.
Hmm.
One of the major things I had to learn as I began to pursue question of origin of life is that chemistry typically doesn't deal with a time component. You deal with things in a laboratory, and you can truly extrapolate them because things don't necessarily change, the laws don't change, and the principles don't change.
Mm-hmm.
And when you began to think in terms of something began, you observe something today, and then you extend it into the past with some kind of legitimate inferential mm-hmm. process. You hope it's valid. And so that, in that extent, it's different.
And what role did Michael Polanyi play in your thinking in the early, you know, questions you had about origin of life and intelligent design?
A big part, because it was while I was still at Iowa State that a student brought the mail by one day, and it happened to be the latest issue of CNE News, the official magazine of the American Chemical Society. Chemical Engineering News had a special feature that issue, August 21st, 1967, The Life Transcending Physics and Chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the featured article, and it caused quite a buzz, not only in our university, but I think around the world as well, because it raised issues specifically in challenging the notion that life is mere chemistry.
How did that sit with many of your colleagues and faculty that you had at that time?
Well, they thought that obviously this is a misunderstanding. He's a great scientist. He's turned to be a philosopher, and so we can discount some of this. But most people, I think, thought that it was unclear as to what he really meant. His one phrase that was the most provocative of all was, after he showed the basis for which that laws of chemistry and physics could not account for the sequencing problem of linking amino acids up to make a protein, the question rises then, well, if the laws of chemistry and physics don't do it, then what does?
Hmm.
And his only answer was a profoundly informative intervention, which was vague enough without amplification as to what it meant. And everybody got excited, thinking all sorts of things from that. But he never said, and he wrote elsewhere about it and gave more lectures trying to clarify, but mostly it was settle the troops down and don't get them too excited about this.
Okay.
It'll pass, too.
Okay, all right. So in the end, did Polanyi, does he fall into the intelligent design camp, or is he just asking dangerous questions that intelligent design proponents then thought were worth giving a different answer to?
Well, they're only considered dangerous today. I think he was asking a question. He had been tracking that for several years. It wasn't just something new to him. He had been on this for 5 or 6 years before, at least. I mean, there are hints that he was going in this direction as far back as his book on personal knowledge back in 1958. So in the early 60s, he gave a series of lectures at Yale in which he spelled out some of these issues that he talked about in not only this article in Chemical Engineering News, but other articles he wrote subsequent to that. But Polanyi was not trying to be a troublemaker. He was honestly trying to deal with what everybody was dealing with at that time, and that is the genetic code and what does it really mean and how to understand it.
Mm-hmm. So obviously the origin of life required the generation of a lot of information, and maybe this is a rhetorical question, we've already answered it, but just so you can nail this down for our listeners, why were your studies about the origin of life so relevant to the intelligent design hypothesis?
Well, they became relevant because the essence of the origin of life problem was to account for the cell, where it came from, and inside the cell, as all readers and listeners are now aware, is this tremendous amount of what became known as information. Well, information back in the 60s and in the early 70s was not as clearly understood and well defined as it is today. It was fairly ambiguous for more than a decade, and a lot of variant uses of the term, and so it was more confusing than helpful in many cases. But we did use the word information and tried to deal with it in our book, The Mystery of Life's Origin. And we felt that at the time that the information is what is meant by the specific sequences inside a protein, and the nucleotide sequences account for the sequences of amino acids in a protein. And the search for the genetic code was to figure out some way in which those sequences of nucleotides could account for those sequences of amino acids in a protein. And the answer turned out to be the genetic code, but that had to be worked out. And Francis Crick, the co-discoverer of the double helical model or structure for DNA, I understood very early that this term information had a specific biological meaning or sense. And he used it very much like the idea of letters conveying a message.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote a note to his son shortly before the famous appearance of his own article in Nature magazine with James Watson, in which he told his son that DNA is a code. He didn't say it is like a code. He said it is a code with emphasis on the word is.
Mm.
And later in 1958, he wrote an article in which he spelled out more clearly that exactly what he meant by information is exactly the specific sequences of these structures. And so in that sense, they are like, we can use that word now, like letters in a book.
Mm-hmm.
So they, in terms of the, what they convey, it's the same type of thinking that you would use.
So this obviously is the information sequence problem that you've talked about in your book, The Mystery of Life's Origin. Why do you view it as the biggest challenge to a naturalistic origin of life hypothesis?
Well, the naturalistic origin of life hypothesis must come up with some non-biological or abiotic source for the sequencing.
Mm-hmm.
And it has not so far been able to do this. And I think there are good in-principle reasons why not only have they not done it, but they won't do it. And for the same reason that Michael Polanyi said that the laws of chemistry and physics cannot account for the structure of DNA. And he didn't mean the structure of DNA, but the message sequences, mm-hmm. the nucleotide sequences. In that sense, I think there's an in-principle barrier against a naturalistic solution to this problem.
Mm.
Although they continue to try, and that's what makes the pursuit so heated sometimes, and so interesting to read and follow and study.
So I want to talk to you about your book, The Mystery of Life's Origin, which was published in 1982, is that right?
84,
okay. And you co-published that with Roger Olson and Walter Bradley. How did you get involved with that project?
Well, in 1976, I think it was, Bradley and Olson already had a manuscript they had written, preliminary, on the subject of the origin of life. And I was asked to read it and give a preliminary evaluation. And my thought was, where's the chemistry? This is a subject that asks to be considered from a chemical point of view as well. And there's a lot of good information about geology and thermodynamics, but the chemical discussion was a little light, to say the least. And so Bradley said, well, you know, you're the chemist, you write it. So that's how I got into the project. It was not mine to start with. I came in later. And by the way, I can say this, that in the writing of the book, there was a tremendous problem, not only to get three authors to sound like one, but another problem was Bradley had just taken a new position at Texas A&M, and he didn't have a lot of free time to redo a manuscript. And Roger Olson had just taken a new job at a waste management plant, now dealing with nuclear waste type materials, and he didn't have a lot of time to revamp a manuscript. So one of the reasons that my name is first on the author list is due to the fact that I wasn't trying to take over, so to speak. It's just that I was the only one that had time to work on it.
Okay, interesting. Wow. So obviously your chemistry contributions to this book, I think, are some very strong arguments, arguments that I've used in the past when I've discussed this issue, and I've really thought they were very compelling. So one point I'd like you to explain to our listeners is, how, in your view, does the Gibbs free energy equation falsify a naturalistic explanation for the origin of life?
Well, the equation itself, Gibbs free energy, you have to understand, every chemical reaction has to satisfy or does satisfy the conditions of the Gibbs free energy function. And this is something you learn as a beginning chemistry student in physical chemistry. The part that is difficult is that most studies of thermodynamics deal with a thermodynamic terms of a Gibbs free energy, but they're dealing with small molecules. Mm. If you are dealing with polymers like a macromolecule of DNA or a protein, different aspects of the Gibbs free energy function come into play. And it was these, as we spell out in our book, The Mystery of Life's Origin, that were important. And the, I don't want to get into it here because it's rather esoteric if you're not a chemist, but I thought it was very important for our discussion of it in the book. And it's not so much that the Gibbs free energy stands in the way of a naturalistic solution. It's that the Gibbs free energy characterizes what must be accomplished if you're going to have a molecule of a certain substance form. And a point in our book about this is that there are theoretical reasons why attempts in the laboratory to produce proteins and DNA, for example, have failed. Mm-hmm. They have failed because they have failed to provide an abiotic or non-biological way to arrive at what we call configurational entropy in that function. So it's not so much that it stands in the way, it's the how do they, I would say it from a naturalistic perspective, how to arrive at an abiotic source of this part of the Gibbs free energy function. That's the goal.
Okay.
But most chemists dealing with the origin of life, in my observation over the years, many of them, or perhaps most of them, they're pretty weak on the thermodynamic aspects, and so they would easily slip over this and not consider this a very important issue. Hmm.
Very interesting. One point that you make in The Mystery of Life's Origin, which I am willing to bet was one of the sections that you contributed, and it's an argument against a naturalistic origin of life that I think really deserves to have more attention given to it. And that is the problem of dehydration synthesis and how you have to have a mechanism to remove the water that's produced during the formation of large polymers, or any polymer for that matter. Could you explain this argument for our listeners?
Yes, the formation of these polymers entails what is known as a dehydration step, where you try to link two molecules together. In the process of creating the bond to join them, you split off a water molecule. The point is that it's difficult to do that in a water environment like an ocean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so how to get around that difficulty has been one of the significant barriers to a naturalistic origin of life, yes.
And if I can elaborate a little bit, I've always found it interesting, the primordial soup is supposedly a pond or an ocean of prebiotic monomers that for some reason spontaneously formed. But to then have those monomers form polymers, you can't do that in an aqueous environment. At least you can't do it, unless you have a way to remove the water. And so while the first step in the origin of life might be able to take place in water, the second step cannot. And I've never heard a good answer to this objection. And I think that it deserves to have more attention given to it, given the fact that especially many astrobiologists are promoting this view to the public that if you want to make life on another planet, all you need to do is just add water. You hear this phrase in the media sometimes, making life, just add water. Well, of course, not only is that ridiculously oversimplifying the situation, but water, for certain steps of the origin of life, actually inhibits what's necessary to produce life. So I find it quite ironic.
Well, yes. The reason why water is considered to be such an important ingredient for life is to have a medium in which the chemical reactions can take place in. But you're right, there is this problem if you have water available and you're trying to bring about a chemical reaction and try to split that water out in the midst of that same water environment. Mm-hmm. That's why chemists make their money as a synthetic chemist by figuring out ways in which to do this artificially. But we're trying to do it in an origin of life situation where we mimic a realistic situation and where that water would have been available. And that becomes a lot more difficult.
Mm. Well, this is what I learned in high school chemistry was Le Chatelier's principle, which is that a reaction does not like to go forward in the presence of its product. And so, I've heard hypotheses that, okay, maybe the primordial soup spilled up onto the side of a volcano where it got heated And somehow you just had a perfectly finely tuned balance between dehydrating and evaporating the water off, but not cooking your chemicals so quickly that, you know, you destroyed any polymers that were forming and turned them back into tar or goop or something like that. It just seems like a fine line that it'd be very difficult to walk to get through this step of dehydration synthesis under natural conditions.
Well, I would say that it's easy to make a caricature of what the origin of life chemist is trying to do here, but there's a lot more legitimacy in what's being tried than maybe many listeners will think. Yes, you do have the problems, the difficulties, and they are trying to envision a set of circumstances where create a scenario in your mind about how, if certain conditions existed, then you might have a little pool area nearby, a hot a fumarole or some kind of a hot object that can boil off the water, evaporate it, and thereby concentrate the chemicals. And so these are legitimate. We find places naturally all the time where such conditions exist. But after a while, it does become sort of like a Rube Goldberg machine to get all the different arrangements just right in which you can take the product of this happening and use it as input for some next stage. So the beginning stages are much easier than the later stages.
Especially when you get to the information sequence problem.
Exactly.
Let me just close with this question. Do you feel that your book, The Mystery of Life's Origin, is still relevant today? And what is the state of current origin of life research, in your opinion?
Well, I think that origin of life research has changed considerably since the 1980s. For example, in the 1980s, people very much were still looking for a solution to be found for the problem here on the Earth. Well, today, the community of scientists seem to be divided, much more so than 25 years ago. And many have already concluded that for a whole host of reasons, it would be very difficult for life to have gotten started naturally here on this planet. Therefore, it needed some help. And maybe one of the ways in which could help out the situation would be to have comets bring truckloads of materials here and dump them on the planet. And then this would be a source for the organic materials that could then, in different places and different locales, bring about the kind of reactions that would go from one step to the next, and eventually maybe something more positive would happen toward building life. However, as far as the main outline in our book of the kind of arguments that are given and the kind of legitimate questions that are raised, I think our book is still quite relevant and valid in that terms. We don't talk about a lot of issues today that people are talking about, but you can easily see how the principles we talk about can be applied to it.
Well, thank you very much for this wonderful discussion of your famous book, The Mystery of Life's Origin, a very foundational work for the intelligent design movement, especially in identifying, I think, the information sequence problem as one of the key questions that needs to be answered. So I think we'll talk more about the origin of intelligent design in a few minutes here in another podcast. But thank you very much, Dr. Thaxton, for your interview.
Thank you.
This is Casey Luskin with the Intelligent Design the Future podcast. Thanks for listening.
Music on ID the Future comes courtesy of composer Yuri Mamchur. Visit www.yuriproductions.com and check out his latest CD, In the Harbor. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Discovery President is Bruce Chapman. ID the Future Managing Editor is Robert Crowther. And the producer is Keith Finn. ID the Future and ID Science in the News is copyright Discovery Institute 2006. For more information, visit www.discovery.org or www.idthefuture.com.